I'm Wade Keller, editor and publisher of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter and former host here at PW Torch Livecast. If you're looking for my shows, they have moved as of July 2017. They're now called the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, available through Podcast One. Enter Wade Keller on your podcast app or iTunes and subscribe to the new Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, where I cover Raw and my first show of the week, SmackDown, with my second show of the week, and then the Flagship Edition with a co-host, and we cover a broad array of pro wrestling current events, and then I end the week with a weekly interview. That's the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, now at Podcast One. Subscribe today. Just search Wade Keller. Welcome to the PW Torch Livecast for Friday, December 1st, 2017. I'm Wade Keller, host of the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast on Podcast One, and longtime editor and founder of Pro Wrestling Torch. The newsletter dates back to 1987, our website dates back to 1999, and the PW Torch Livecast dates back to 2009. And on this Best of Livecast selection, we're actually featuring an interview that has never aired on the Livecast before. It was part of the VIP after show following the main free version of an interview that I did 5 years ago, November 30th, 2012, with former WWE creative team member John Carl. In this 71-minute segment, never before heard for free, previously VIP exclusive, you can hear John Carl talk about what Vince McMahon was like, what surprised him about Vince McMahon, what were Triple H and John Cena like. He talks about pranks on a private jet with Vince McMahon, and also what was Paul Heyman like during the WWE ECW era. This is a fascinating behind-the-scenes look at WWE's inner operations with somebody who worked closely with some of their biggest names, the biggest names in that company. So I think you're going to enjoy this a lot. Again, this is a first-time offering for free for our PW Torch Livecast listeners. There's a lot more where this came from if you become a VIP member. You can instantly gain access to over 80 interviews that I've conducted over the years with ex-WWE creative team members, spanning from Vince Russo and Ed Ferrara during the Attitude Era and the Monday Night War era, all the way through recent years. So check out a VIP membership. Just go to pwtorch.com/govip. One of the cool perks of a VIP membership is that on the VIP audio feed, the livecasts are included, along with all the other VIP exclusive podcasts, but the live casts on the VIP feed have plugs and commercials and ads removed. So it's a better, more streamlined experience. It's one of the bonuses that comes with a VIP membership. So go check out details. We'd love to have you as a member. pwtorch.com/govip. Also today features my new interview with Cowboy James Storm. Now, this is a new interview on my Podcast One show, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast. Check out my interview today with James Storm. Just search Wade Keller at podcastone.com or search Wade Keller wherever you listen to podcasts, including on Apple Podcasts. The Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast logo will pop up, and just click subscribe and you are in. You can also always find links to all of our podcasts, the live casts, the VIP shows, and the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcasts at pwtorch.com. Check it out. We just launched our new mobile interface this week, a new mobile website that I think you'll enjoy. And keep visiting pwtorch.com every day for the latest news, editorials, my live TV reports and pay-per-view reports, and more. So here we go with the 2012 interview, just 5 years ago this week, with ex-WWE creative team member John Carl. All right, John, we now move into the VIP After Show portion of the program. I, again, very much appreciate your time and staying with us for the VIP After Show portion of the program. We've got some good questions on email. Let me dive into those so I don't let those people down who sent those in. One, a VIP member, Casey from Huntington, West Virginia,
said, John, was there any talk about doing a WCW reunion show like what was done with ECW in 2006?
Plain and simple, no. There were a few ideas from WCW that we, you know, had jokingly talked about revisiting, but there was never any actual serious discussion of going back towards WCW. There just isn't that fervent fan base that needed a reunion.
Exactly. I'm with you on that. And I mean, who would you put together who TNA hadn't signed and used up?
Exactly. You would basically be taking some of your top guys at WWE at the time, like a guy like Booker or something like that, or the other guys were already over at TNA at some point. So you weren't missing them because they never went away.
Yep. And conceptually, unlike ECW, WCW wasn't something different than WWE. It might have been inferior or better, but it was the same thing.
Right.
ECW had an identity to it that was separate enough to do a theme show.
Right. WCW and WWE, it came down to what the creative and who the superstars of the time were. It wasn't a hugely separate entity in the way that it was presented.
Yeah. Yeah. Like Paul Heyman always said about TNA when he used to talk about them, they needed an identity, a separate identity. When people said TNA, you knew what you were talking about, and
yep. It
just never, you know, WCW wasn't like that, and certainly in the end wasn't something you'd want to even repeat or revisit. The last couple years were awful. TNA, when they went head-to-head on Monday night with Raw, I believe you were there for that, because that would have been early 2009, I think.
Nope, that was 2010.
Oh, it was?
I remember,
okay.
Because at that point I was working at a bar.
Oh, okay.
And the bar that I was working at, I worked pretty much every Monday night shift, and it was a sports bar. And, we used to get all the Monday night football games and stuff like that, but I'd always have one TV on that would have Raw. And I remember the night of the head-to-head, it just so happened to be a terrible Monday night football game, or I think it was like the week after Monday night football had ended. So it was only me and a group of regulars who actually liked wrestling, and every other TV was Raw and every other TV was TNA. And we kept switching back and forth on the audio between the two nights. So
what just from afar, what did you think about TNA's attempt to do that first show in early January and then a short run a little bit later in the year?
Loved the first episode. They pulled out every stunt and every appearance they could put in there. And I loved watching that episode. And I would say the only points we really switched back to Raw's audio that night was during commercial breaks and when Bret Hart was on. Other than that, I think we honestly watched more TNA that night than we did WWE. And I don't think it was in the cards. I don't think enough fans were either aware of it or cared enough about TNA to keep that longevity going week to week, because they didn't even beat them in ratings on that first night. There was no way, without pulling out tons of, you know, spending and stunts and stuff like that, that they could have built up the way WCW did with Nitro and Raw. So
I think Eric Bischoff maybe miscalculated what it was that made Nitro work, because Raw was a more vulnerable product at the time, and the budget and the production values and the, you know, Jeff Hardy, Rob Van Dam, Hulk Hogan. I mean, you can look at the list of people. It wasn't completely unfathomable that
right.
TNA might catch fire enough to compete, but it was more risky than maybe even Nitro was, although that's easy to say in retrospect, because I know.
Well, it was more risky because you're taking people who don't have as much money and throwing all that money out on the first night. Ted Turner, if WCW failed, he still had everything else to line his wallet. But, you know, the Dixie Carter and her family only had so much money that they could throw towards this product. And if it didn't work or it actually put them bankrupt, they were done. So I do consider it a riskier move.
And WCW had just a fan base that was much larger built in, that was excited, that was rooting for them as a home team. I mean, they were, you know.
Yeah, you had the NWA as your fan base that just converted over when WCW's name was the prominent name. That was all there for them already.
Yeah, and WCW Saturday Night, and there was even, you know, just there was such a greater infrastructure to support. I remember Kevin Sullivan telling me at the bar after the first Nitro, Wade, it's going to take at least six. You know, he was a booker, so he had a reason to downplay
right.
expectations. And he's like, oh, Wade, nobody even knows where TNT is on the cable. It's going to take 6 to 12 weeks even for people to know where TNT is.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, the ratings came in and, you know, it was just shocking because they beat Raw the first time. So, yeah, it was, it, you know, if you go back to that time frame, I mean, there were the expectations for Nitro were tempered. Eric Bischoff was nervous. He was sitting there watching the replay because I always replayed it. He was watching the replay afterwards, and he just had this, like, proud father look on his face because he was really happy with how that first show at Mall of America turned out. But there were not expectations that they were going to beat Raw right away. I mean, that was a very pleasant surprise. TNA, though, clearly just didn't have, you know, Spike TV didn't have the patience, nor did TNA have the fan base to make it work right away. But
yeah, and that's the hard part is because now it's, you know, everything comes down to money. And it's, you know, someone like Spike, if they feel like they're going to hurt their Thursday night rating and not pull as strong of a number on Monday night, why bother doing the Monday night when they could at least maintain a certain amount of money on a Thursday?
How much have you paid attention to TNA over the years when you were there and since you left WWE?
I wane in and out of TNA. It kind of depends on the storylines for me. Same way with WWE is for me right now. Like if it's a story that I start to care about, like I was watching the night of CM Punk's pipe bomb promo. I loved it. And I was following like every minute of programming from that Monday night promo until the SummerSlam stuff happened. And then they did all the stuff with like Kevin Nash and, you know, that made me stop being so hardcore about it. Same thing with TNA. There are certain stories that TNA has done. And, you know, I also am friends with a lot more of the roster at TNA right now than I am with the current roster at WWE. Like, I think I only probably know personally a third of the guys on WWE TV right now just because they keep putting so many new guys on right now. So, you know, if I see a tweet from Jeff Hardy saying that he's going to be, you know, in a match against Kurt Angle, you know, I know it's going to be a great match, so I'll make sure to put that on. But, you know, if it's just a normal week, I may or may not watch, depending on what I'm doing.
What are one or two pieces of advice or just thoughts that you've had about what TNA could have done differently to be ahead of where they are now as they've tried to mature as a company and grow?
Get rid of Vince Russo sooner. I know the guy has done a lot for the business, but I think bringing him on to TNA, especially in a very public role, was a mistake. It may have sounded like a good idea on paper, but after the Attitude Era, I never saw the benefit of Vince Russo, especially after the night that changed it all, which, you know, could roughly be translated into the night that started killing WCW.
Yeah. And Vince Russo was somebody who I don't think sometimes gets enough credit for instigating and igniting some of the good ideas that led to the boom period.
Right.
Paul Heyman, Eric Bischoff, a lot of people deserve credit, Vince McMahon, Steve Austin, but Vince Russo should be in that conversation.
Absolutely.
But he did so much bad stuff, especially when Vince McMahon wasn't there to edit him. And then his personality is such where in person he's engaging and likable, and that's how he keeps his position and his friends and all that, and he builds loyalty with people in power. But publicly, he just created an image of being a buffoon. And Jerry Jarrett wouldn't even admit to me that Vince Russo was going to be on TNA Creative when they launched. I mean, he was scared of breaking that news, but other people wanted it really badly. And, you know, it just, yeah, the whole... How much, when you're on WWE Creative, how much do you guys talk about previous people in the creative team and their eras and their contributions? Like, is that something you guys kind of track and kind of know this was a good stretch because this guy was a lead writer and, you know, that kind of thing? Is there that kind of acknowledgement of the history and lineage?
There really wasn't that kind of conversation going on because when I got there, it was a pretty new creative team in terms of half of the members. And then the other half had been there for years. Like you had Michael, you had Dusty, you had Brian, you had Ed, and you had Lagana. Those are the guys who had been on the creative team at that point. I think the shortest run of those guys was like 6 years, which was Koski. But then my group all kind of came in around the same time. Like DeJoseph was about a year before me, and then it was myself, Dave Kapoor, Andrew Greenberg, and Goldstein, and Alex Greenfield, and they were all pretty new at that time. So there wasn't really a lot to question about the past because we were still trying to establish ourselves as a team. You didn't want to say, oh, what was it like working with Vince Russo, when the response was probably going to be, why does it matter what it was like working with Vince Russo? You know, do your own stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like there wasn't even really that desire to ask about it. Because the one person you really wonder about working with is Vince. He's the one that, what's it going to be like working with this guy? You know, Vince Russo, like I said, the name, and this isn't a dig at him in a professional level, but the name has a negative connotation to me personally, because I remember watching that episode of Nitro. Like, I was on and off for a while with, you know, WWE and Nitro going back and forth. And I think that was the last full episode of Nitro that I ever watched.
Wow.
Other than the final episode with the buyout. That was,
right.
Yeah, between then, I don't think I ever watched a full episode of Nitro.
How much of an enigma was Brian Gewirtz, and what did you think of working with him, and how do you evaluate his contributions to the creative process?
I'll start with the positive, which is Brian's creative process. Brian is a booking genius. He can take any scenario and give you a story out of it. And I think that's a skill. Like, you know, I've talked about certain people who have a natural charisma or a natural ability to make people get over just by being in the ring with them. Brian is such a talented storyteller, and he doesn't get the credit for it, because what he can tell you and what actually makes it to TV are different because other people put their hands in the pot. If you look at some of just Brian's purest form stories that he had, I think they would be in much better shape right now than they currently are. As far as working with Brian, as I mentioned before on the live cast, Brian is an introvert, and he's very, very hard to get to know on a personal level, and especially be comfortable with on a personal level. You know, we never fought, we never clashed, and we didn't dislike each other, but we just could never really connect on any level other than professionally working with each other. I think he's just that personality that he likes to be friends with who he's friends with, and
yeah,
that was kind of his set group.
What was there a jealousy that he was as tight with Vince McMahon as he was, and how tight was he with Vince, and why do you think the Vince-Brian dynamic worked as well as it did over the years?
It wasn't jealousy to me. It was respect. Like, this guy, it's not because he was a kiss ass, because Brian is the farthest thing from that. He was one of the people who was actually brave enough to say to Vince if he didn't like an idea, and he wouldn't say, "Sir, you're wrong." He would say, "Sir, do you think this idea could work better?" And the fact that he was able to stand up and knew how to talk to Vince was a skill that I think any other writer or any other person who wants to work for that company in a creative aspect should learn, because he was able to survive for so long because of that. Like, I've seen Vince go head to head with people, but I never saw that with Brian. And I think that's why their dynamic worked, because there was a mutual respect between the two of them, where Vince knew that whatever Brian said, he believed in, and he knew what he was talking about. And I think that Brian never tried to make himself sound smarter than Vince, and that's why the two of them were able to get along and work together so well for so long.
Yeah, really interesting. Well, how did you react to the news that Brian Gewirtz had been evicted from the creative process for the most part, moved into a consulting role? Did that shock you? Did you think he was a lifer?
I did. I thought he was a lifer. I think I put out the tweet that night, the second I heard it, saying that I couldn't believe that Brian was no longer a part of that creative team. Like, every major story in wrestling following the Attitude Era, Brian worked on. Brian was a part of that WWE blood. You know, I thought he was going to be there and, you know, move into other positions within the company, whether it have to do with, you know, web direction or anything, where he was still there. I never thought he wouldn't be a stalwart member in that company. Like, the fact that he's a consultant now, you know, from my own perspective, it's probably because he works better with The Rock than anybody else. And I think that's why they are keeping him as a consultant, because Rocky probably doesn't want to work with anybody else, because him and Brian have magic when they work together.
What were you able to observe about that dynamic? I've heard so much about it, but did you get to see that kind of come to fruition, or did that happen sooner than when you got there? I assume it goes back to when Rock was even full-time, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I know Brian worked with Rock during his initial run, the end of it, and then anytime he made appearances. You know, there are very few people in the wrestling business that I haven't at least met, and Rock is one of those few people. He only made one appearance with WWE in the time that I was there, and that was the Hall of Fame. And when he was doing that, him and Brian were working together on his speech, and that was kind of like in a closed-off room because, you know, they only have one day to prepare for everything because of all the stuff that's going on with WrestleMania that week. So, you know, I never actually got the opportunity to meet The Rock, so I never got to see that dynamic in person.
Okay.
Rich Fan, formerly of the Primetime Friday Laughcast with Bruce Mitchell here. I want to tell you about my new show, The Deep Dive with Rich Fan. On Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern weekly, join us as we dive into a single subject, some weeks as serious as race, gender, and stereotyping in wrestling, to as fun as which IC champs could fit into another era, and anything in between. We'll have guests from inside and outside the Torch family to cover the subject of the week, and of course your calls and emails. Prior to each episode, I'll put out on social media the subject and some notes, places where you can also bone up on the subject of the week if you're so inclined. I'll also devote shows to two of my favorite international promotions, New Japan Pro Wrestling and Progress. All are welcome. No secret handshakes here because Saturday nights on the livecast are officially all right for diving.
Oh, how surprised were you? Because there had to be talk of it while you were there. John Cena started to make an issue of it, I think probably in the late 2000s. But were you surprised when Rock came back and actually made what looked like a multi-year commitment to be part of WrestleMania?
I can't say I was surprised because I always felt like it was just a matter of time.
Was that everyone's attitude too? Like, did because I think some people thought it was a shot in the dark that he would actually come back with that level of commitment.
I think we always knew it was a possibility. Like, there would be pitches to, you know, can we have him come back for this? Can we have him come back for that? But you didn't want to actually send that idea through to the boss until you had something that was good enough for it. Like, you don't want to just bring Rock back for one match at WrestleMania, because it felt try hard when that happened at WrestleMania 20. Like, he came back, teamed with Mick, and it was what it was. It was a forgotten match on a huge card.
Yeah.
So you wanted to make sure that if you brought him back, it was the biggest deal possible. And, you know, I just thought it was a matter of time before they found that big deal.
Very good. Let me, as promised, go to an email question here. This comes from
Yep.
Andrew. He says, I'm just wondering what talent John worked with in WWE that he could tell would be a major player in the years to come. Also, what was the one angle he always wanted to pitch that never came to fruition, or did pitch that never came to fruition, either way?
As far as talent that I knew would be major players, working the indies, I knew who Punk was. I was never a big video guy. I never traded tapes with people, so I never got to see a lot of his work. I remember seeing him on an episode of, like, Sunday Night Heat or something when it was still broadcast on TV, and I was like, oh, I recognize that guy's name. And then he had, you know, a sick match on Sunday Night Heat, and I was like, wow, this guy's really good. It just so happened that my first week on the road was at, like, episode 6 of ECW, and it was the Hammerstein Ballroom episode where Punk made his debut.
Yep.
And I just remember watching that because we had recorded Raw and SmackDown the day before. So it was a skeleton crew, basically, with only ECW people there. And I just remember watching Paul Heyman shoot Punk backstage and, you know, this is his debut to the world. And just remember thinking, damn, this guy is going to be phenomenal. And, you know, obviously time told the tale on that one, that he's lived up to and surpassed expectations that most people had for him.
How about, any other names that you, I think you were around for the rise of The Miz, for instance?
Yep, I was there for The Miz. Interestingly enough, both The Miz and CM Punk's first televised matches as a part of the roster were the same week. Miz's first match of all people was against Tatanka, which, you know, I grew up during the Attitude Era, and I remember watching Tatanka, and, you know, The Miz against Tatanka was like the first match I remember watching at that Super Show. And I think that's the only match I actually remember because it was Miz in it. And I was just like, wow, this guy, when he turns on this character, it is impossible to like him. And you know, I got the opportunity to work with Miz a lot once they started doing the dirt sheet and the chick magnet and all that kind of stuff. So he was one of those guys that I always thought there was more money in Miz as a talker, as an in-ring talent.
How about John Morrison? I think there's people who think talent-wise, look-wise, he's good, didn't have the height. Promos were a struggle, personality a little bit kind of quirky, maybe hard to connect with. But there were some real bright spots that, you know, and people thought he'd be the next Shawn Michaels at one point. What do you think of him, and what do you think went wrong?
Still a huge fan of John. John is one of those people that I've been lucky enough to stay in touch with and still consider a friend. John, you needed to find the right character for him. And I think that's what they did when they changed him from Johnny Nitro to John Morrison. You know, that they nailed it perfectly with what they had it to do with him. And, you know, John talks a little bit slower and he has that quirky sense of humor. But when you really get to know John, and that's what we did with the dirt sheet, it's hard to really hate him because just he's out there with some of the stuff he would say. Like, we made sure in the first like 12 episodes of the dirt sheet, there was always a, you know, that's not at the Palace of Wisdom joke, and that we made sure it was there every time. And Miz would just give him a look like, what are you talking about? And that was kind of one of those moments with John that you would just have in a conversation. And that's why I liked him so much. And I think, you know, once they just made him into a generic babyface who, you know, did some high flying stuff, that's where they lost that steam, because John wasn't given a personality anymore. He was just cool guy, flowing hair. And I think John as a heel who doesn't even realize he's a heel is much more interesting than John as just a high flying babyface.
Yeah. Yep. Was there an angle you pitched or wanted to pitch that never came to fruition? That was the other part of the question.
Well, obviously, like I said, the Katie Lee, Paul Burchill thing,
yeah.
That I still think that would have been money, but it's definitely not, you know, TV, PG, family friendly and all that stuff, unfortunately. I wanted to take the Jillian Hall character farther, and I understand why now that we didn't do it, and it's because the Divas as a whole, using them for TV time isn't where the money is with them. Especially now where, you know, it's the Divas are getting more website traffic than people, but a Diva match will tank a little bit in ratings compared to, you know, bigger name talent. So I understood why you couldn't dedicate so much time to a comedy character with her. But we just wanted to, like, you know, have her doing backstage stuff. And it would have all been really entertaining. It's just at the time that they didn't need entertainment value. They needed to build stars, and building a star with Diva is probably one of the hardest things anybody can accomplish within that company.
I know that the creative team sometimes pays attention to what's being said on the internet. The internet doesn't speak with one voice, and
yeah.
Obviously, and there isn't just everyone's in agreement, and they all either love or hate the same show or blame the same people. But how much did you notice people paying attention to the internet, the newsletters, a podcast, whatever it was during that stretch of time? Social media wasn't quite as big.
Right.
How much did you guys pay attention to that and resent sometimes that you'd get blamed for things that aired on TV that actually you didn't like either because you pitched something different? Like, how sensitive were you guys and aware were you guys in terms of following the opinion out there?
I have a very love-hate relationship with the wrestling community online because there have been two times where I have been poorly misrepresented because of the internet. The first time was right as I got hired. It was an announcement online that myself, Dave Kapoor, Andrew, and the writer's assistant, Pants was his nickname for ECW, just because he has a very Greek name and I really don't want to butcher it out of respect to him. But they were like, you know, four new creative team members hired, and somebody was quoted as saying that John has next to no experience in the world of wrestling.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, out of the four people, I'm the only one with any previous experience out of the world of wrestling. And, you know, I'm not trying to put myself over by any means and being like, you know, I was an expert at wrestling, but I at least was going in there with an understanding of certain parts of wrestling that these other guys, you know, they could have been lifelong fans, and Andrew's an encyclopedia when you ask him about stuff that happened in NWA. But, you know, my understanding of wrestling was different than Andrew's. So for somebody to say I had no experience in wrestling, that kind of put a bad taste in my mouth about the internet. So while I was there, I pretty much avoided looking at any dirt sheets or, you know, newsletters or anything like that. And keep in mind, I definitely separate the dirt sheet sites from the wrestling journalism sites, because there are some that are just all about doing, you know, the big story and the rumor and stuff like that, while other ones actually have a degree of journalistic integrity. So,
sure. Yep.
Right. As far as the rest of the team, I think we also avoided it too, because, you know, we were always on company computers, and with the concern about things being leaked, the last thing you wanted was something major to get leaked to a website, whether or not you were the one that leaked it. But, you know, we didn't know if they had tracking cookies on our computer and stuff like that. So say, you know, one of the sites leaked a WrestleMania spoiler, and then if you go into my browser history, I was on that site looking at something. Whether or not I sent them the email or called somebody or texted somebody, I didn't want to be even at risk that I could get blamed for anything like that. Because there is a small mentality of fear, especially, like I said, you know, being new to that team, you don't want to give somebody the opening to be like, all right, well, it's possible you screwed this up, you're out of there.
True. Yep. And how often did it come up that something leaked out and somebody threw a fit about it, that some future plan or even a plan that was nixed made it out there, you know, whether it was in a newsletter or a website? How often did that come up where you're like, uh-oh, or somebody brought it up and was scolding the lack of the leaking of information?
It usually didn't happen much. For the most part, the way that it would be worded or something like that is it was somebody making up a rumor and trying to make it seem like they had a credible source on it, and it felt more coincidence than it did somebody leaking information. You didn't have a lot of times where something would be dead on that you had to like change stuff around because you didn't want the website to be right about it. And again, like I said, we didn't follow stuff really on it. So it was more so news about, you know, if somebody got suspended or let go. Sometimes we'd hear about the suspension off of the internet sooner than we would our own email chain. Like there were times that WWE.com would post, you know, the list of releases if there was like the mass exodus.
Yeah.
And we would see it on the website before we'd get the list from talent relations on who was gone.
But, yeah, I think there was a time during that stretch, kind of the mid to late 2000s, where you could tell the attitude within .com or Vince McMahon's attitude was, we want to be, if the news is going to get out,
we're going to give the news.
Deliver it. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, we're going to make the other independent websites less scoop oriented because we're going to just beat them to the punch. If it's going to get out, we might as well be the one to get the clicks.
Right, and the thing with that too was, you know, you look at website traffic generated off of stories and stuff like that. You know, the world of wrestling right now, 95% of all wrestling website traffic is still going to WWE.com. So it's still such a small percentage that are going to, you know, even TNA, Ring of Honor, or the various other wrestling websites. The majority of the world doesn't even know about those other sites because to them, if they're just the basic WWE fan, it's plastered all over WWE programming, so they have no reason to even look in another place for it.
Exactly, yep. All right, well, let's go to another email. This is from Scott Briller. He says, John Cena was ending his 380 days as champion in the 2006 to 2009 era as CM Punk will break next week. My question, can your guest discuss how big of a topic it was back then for everyone to give their two cents on how Cena was to lose the title and how creative today is buzzing how Punk will lose his title. Some of the syntax here is a little choppy. Like when
right.
A champion like Cena or Punk is a champ for more than 1 year, does Vince basically know when he's going to pull the trigger?
I think it really depends on the story. I don't think there was a plan going into the start of this title reign for Punk saying, hey, we're going to make Punk set a record or, you know, beat something. It was more so this is the time where Punk is going to become champion, and we're going to run with Punk as champion to get where we need to go. You know, if there was a better person to put that title on, I have no question in my mind they would have switched it to somebody else, and Punk would have been just as strong a heel doing whatever else he needed to do. Same with Cena. There isn't the same special feeling for somebody being a champion for 1 year anymore. Like, you're not going to get a 7 year title reign or anything like that back when, you know, you would years and years ago. You know, it's just unheard of now. So you don't go into it with that plan. But if you get to that point, usually somebody like at .com will like post a story and it's like, hey, Cena hit, or Punk hit 250 days on his title reign. Okay, maybe we can work with this, as opposed to going into it saying, all right, this is the guy who's going to set the new recent record or something like that. That doesn't matter as much as figuring out where you want your story to go. And if it coincidentally happens, you know, more benefit for everybody.
Next question, Jason D. says, what was the reaction inside the writer's room when Paul Heyman abruptly quit after December to Dismember when Vince refused to put the ECW title on CM Punk? Were others in Paul's corner, or did most side with Vince going with Bobby Lashley?
That was an interesting night for me. I happened to be the only person riding back from December to Dismember to the hotel with Paul in the car that was going there. Basically, yeah. Everybody, there were two cars set to pick up the writing team, and just the number of people we had, and me being the newest guy on the team at that point, I was obviously going to be last to get back to the hotel, and Paul was finishing up something, and it was just, to me personally, the next day was not a surprise. You know, it's the pay-per-view was far from a success. It was like one of the shortest runtime pay-per-views I think WWE has ever had.
Yep.
You know, a lot of matches fell flat. They didn't feel like pay-per-view matches. You know, some of them felt like they were just another, you know, ECW televised match that just went longer. And, you know, seeing the look on Paul's face that night and stuff like that, it didn't shock me that, you know, we went into the meeting the next day and, you know, everybody left the meeting room except for Paul. And then we were, you know, told that Lagana was going to be the new head of ECW. It was disappointing because I didn't really feel like I got as much out of working with Paul Heyman as I could have. It sounds really selfish, but, you know, I only worked with Paul for a few months, and he's, in my mind, still one of the greatest minds in wrestling. So to only get him for a few months, I felt more gypped that I didn't get to learn more from him.
Compare, you spoke highly about Brian Gewirtz and his creative mind. You just spoke very highly about Paul Heyman and his creative mind. They also seem like, in some ways, very, very different people, personality-wise. How are they both geniuses, and how are they similar and different? Or I don't want to say geniuses, but how are they both gifted and very skilled when it comes to wrestling, creative writing and booking and wrestling? How are they similar, and how are they different?
Brian is a master storyteller, in my mind. He can just make a story out of everything, and wrestling is incidental. Wrestling is just something that he uses as a tool to further the story. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think Paul's, and I know people hesitate to use the word genius with anybody, but Paul's genius is that he is a wrestling storyteller. He understands the stories that work in wrestling that would never work in any other medium. And that's why Paul's creative side is, it's two sides of the same coin. They both work great, but I don't know if Paul's storytelling ability would be as good outside of wrestling, but it's perfect for the world of wrestling.
Total quirk, weird hypothetical, but if TNA could hire either Paul Heyman or Brian Gewirtz, or they could hire both of them and somehow they'd get along and work together, which of those three options do you think would be best for TNA?
Obviously, I would go with hiring both of them. Your storytelling vastly would improve, and I feel like I feel like TNA has improved since bringing both Bruce and David Lagana onto their creative. But if you were to get Lagana, Bruce, Brian, and Paul all in the same room working together and getting along, I think you have the potential for some of the best wrestling stories of the last 15-20 years. You know, obviously I'm taking all, you know, political context and like, you know, all that stuff out of the equation, but just putting that degree of talent all together, you have the potential for the strongest creative team in years.
Were you excited to hear Dave Lagana got hired by TNA? Do you think that there's high hopes for him within that structure and what you know about it to make a difference and maybe be influential in TNA's future?
I was happy for David, first and foremost, as a friend. You know, when Dave got let go from WWE, we never really had a chance to say goodbye to Dave. For the most part, you didn't get chances to say goodbye to guys on the team because sometimes it would happen, like, you know, on a day that you weren't in the office or, you know, it would just be so abrupt and sudden. And Dave was one of those guys that I found out when I was already home one day. And after both of us had been released, Dave started doing his website and stuff like that. And, you know, he's a talented guy. And regardless of the circumstances on why he got let go and, you know, rumor and speculation, he always treated me with respect. He was always cool with me. So to hear that he was given another opportunity, I was really happy for him. You know, talent-wise, Dave knows his stuff. Dave loves wrestling, too. And I don't think there's a storytelling medium that's better for Dave right now than the world of wrestling. You know, he did so much for Ring of Honor, and, you know, it's a shame to see that it's kind of fallen back to where it was years ago. But, you know, he gets wrestling. He understands why certain things need to happen to progress a wrestling storyline. And I think there's too few people that are in creative positions right now that have that understanding. You know, when I hear about people coming from the world of TV into wrestling, Dave and Brian are the two examples of are the two exceptions, because most people who come in from the world of TV don't know a thing about wrestling. And that's what makes me angry when, you know, you see a guy who doesn't get wrestling and doesn't have the same respect for it. And I feel like is almost doing it for the paycheck as opposed to the love of the sport.
You love pro wrestling podcasts, but you might not have time to listen to all of them. We'll help you decide which ones to listen to and keep you up to date on the ones you're missing at pwpodcasts.com. That website features written recaps of all of the top pro wrestling related podcasts, including Steve Austin, Bruce Pritchard, Edge and Christian, and so on. Check it out. It's pwpodcasts.com, your home for written recaps of all pro wrestling personality hosted podcasts.
What percentage of the people in the revolving door of creative walked in and almost offended you with their sensibility and lack of respect for wrestling and just lack of basic knowledge?
Basic respect, I don't think there was anybody when I was there who really disrespected it. But there was definitely a lack of knowledge on certain parts. One story that I always like to tell is we were on a conference call once and somebody said Shawn Michael and then Hornswizzle. I'm not even kidding when they said that.
That's great. And I mean, it's awful. It's horrible, but it's great, yeah.
I know for a fact that after his time was ended at WWE, he landed on his feet and is doing something completely outside of the world of wrestling, and it's so much of a better fit for him.
Yeah.
And like I said, on a conference call, he says Hornswizzle, and thank God it was a conference call with just my writing team. Because if that had ever happened in a conversation with Vince, I could have seen the phone explode in my hand from the anger that would have popped up when hearing that kind of thing.
Would Vince have been more angry at the person who said it or the hiring process that allowed somebody who didn't know that to...
I guarantee it would have been the person who said it, the person who hired him, and the team that he was on for letting that level of knowledge go unnoticed.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
A very different question. Email comes from Sydney, who says, as a female wrestling fan, I can say that women really have a different view of WWE and wrestling. With storylines like AJ and John Cena, which has been insulting if they think pairing two people together with no chemistry will get female fans invested, I'm wondering what your guest says WWE thinks females like. Demographically, how much of WWE's audience is women and how much of the creative process is focused on pleasing them?
I mean, to go back to the start of her question, I don't think WWE is gearing themselves towards women at all at this point. While some of the girls themselves will present themselves as strong female role models, and you look at somebody like Natty Neidhart or Beth Phoenix, who, you know, show their strength and their femininity. I think in terms of storytelling and stuff like that, you're not gearing it at all towards women. You know, that the scene with John Cena and AJ I didn't have the audio on because I was doing something else, but I look over at my TV and I see the most uncomfortable kissing scene in the history of wrestling.
Yes.
I mean, it was the worst kiss I think I've ever seen. And I'm just thinking, who's buying this? Like not even, you know, an ignorant 12-year-old thinks that's how you kiss a hot girl. Like, it was just, it was gross to watch. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, but never in your time there did Stephanie or Vince or a memo come in saying we need to shore up the female demographic?
No, not in my knowledge. It may have been said on a higher level, but I think your demographic perspective was more so worrying about your standard 18 to 25 males for Monday Night Raw. And then I think your major demographic that you paid attention to in any way was certain booking for like SmackDown, because traditionally when it was still on a regular broadcast TV, you had a higher urban demographic. So you wanted African American and Latino stars on that show. Because not every household would have cable. So you'd want a Rey Mysterio, you'd want a Booker, because they would appeal more to who was watching more of that show.
Yeah, Teddy Long, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Teddy's just awesome.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't not like Teddy Long.
Yep, I know. And he's the type of everyman trying to keep control of this crazy roster of wrestlers that is I think, ideal for a GM-type role. I think the viewers have sympathy for him. They trust that he has the best interest in mind of creating an even playing field and, mm-hmm. and enforcing justice. But it's also understandable he would screw up every now and then or not quite cover all bases. I don't know.
Make a tag team match.
Yeah, yes. Yep. Sydney also asked, if you could ask Vince McMahon 5 questions and get an honest answer, what are the questions that popped into your head?
Jeez.
Yeah.
It's a loaded question.
I know. It doesn't have to be 5, but like, you know, any come to mind where, man, you would love to get an honest answer?
I think I would honestly avoid the business side of stuff, and I would honestly want to talk to him more about his father and changing the company over. Like, that's one thing that I got. Every now and then I would be privileged to hear a conversation about that and be there for it. But I never would get the full story because, you know, it would only be, you know, a 20-minute ride from the airport to the arena. I would love to just sit there and pick his brain about what it was like in the early days. And, you know, I had been there and I talked to Linda about that once when we were on a flight on the night of the Chris Benoit tragedy, actually. Me, her, and Mean Gene Okerlund were flying back to Connecticut that night, and I was there for part of it, but I would always love to hear Vince's side of that.
Yeah, yep.
Like how they dealt with, you know, being bankrupt and building it back up. Like there's so much of that story that I would want to hear that I would use all my 5 questions on that.
Yep. All right, if you have time, just a couple more, we can maybe try to hit a few more that got sent in rapid fire. I don't want to eat up too much of your night, but we can wait a long time to do it, and the time's flying by. So,
yep.
Cool. How much do referees help in a match? I know they tell wrestlers how much time is left. I know the wrestlers call the match, but it seems like a lot of talking goes on in some matches between wrestlers and refs. And how much is creative ever interacting with referees?
In terms of creative interacting with referees, it doesn't happen very often. There were a few referees who were like down in developmental who would help write new character pitches for some of the developmental wrestlers too. Like, I think one of Ted DiBiase Jr.'s first pitches, I guess Ted wasn't very good at like typing stuff out. And he had a referee help him with that. Hmm. But as far as our interaction with them, it was minimal. That's more so the match producer's, role to interact with referees.
Yep.
You know, we would have drinks after the bar, or me and Charles Robinson would talk about Xbox because it was just, you know, a mutual interest on the two of us. But, you know, his interaction in terms of the product just didn't really happen. That just wasn't a relationship that really existed. As far as their importance to the match, you know, a referee's reaction is more important to me than telling, you know, the guys in the ring how much time they have left. You know, if a referee isn't lost in the story that's being told in the ring and he looks bored or he doesn't look like he believes what's going on,
yeah,
it's going to take away from the match. And at the same time, if you have a referee who's overselling it and, you know, making a body slam look like a guy just got put through the bottom of the ring, it's going to make it look less believable because somebody's overacting as well.
What do referees do anything else other than go to the ring, work their match, and come back, and then get ready for the next match they're reffing? Do they typically have other roles? I know they've helped set up the ring at times.
Yeah, I mean, there's, like, ring crew and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But they're important part players, but they're not a focus, really.
Yeah, yeah. Next question from RMP. During your tenure, and forgive me if we covered this, we talked about Undertaker, but the question is, during your tenure, was there any consideration for Undertaker losing his streak to any of his opponents?
Yeah, we kind of talked about that. It's like,
yeah.
It's one of those things that was pitched, but it never really came to fruition.
Yep. Man, multiple people asking about storylines that were dropped, so we covered that. I think this coincided with when you were there. This is from Liam. I was wondering, was Mr. Kennedy going to be revealed as Mr. McMahon, and what were the plans for Kennedy after that? Was he going to face Triple H at WrestleMania that year as rumored?
Trying to think back. Like, that's the thing is, like, every storyline, there were, like, 9,000 pitches on the possible outcome.
Yeah.
I don't remember if we ever said we were going to go with Ken. I think Ken was always a red herring because he was, like, so obvious that, you know, Vincent Kennedy, McMahon, Mr. Kennedy, that it would have just been too easy to go with that as the answer. And I think in, at least in my mind, he was always the one that I wanted to be like the big mislead and not actually go with him.
Yeah.
I think for a while because I was on SmackDown, I wasn't so much as focused on that. So it was like, you know, all the discussions on all the possibilities happened in other meetings that I was not a part of.
What did you think of him as a talent, as a wrestler, as a future star?
Ken's awesome. You know, like a person like Miz or like John Morrison, he's so much fun as a heel that you just enjoy watching him, even though you enjoy hating him.
Yeah. TNA tried to go with him and just kind of botched it. And I don't know. It's been unpleasant to most of the way watching him try to figure out where he lands in TNA. John Ott says, 2006 was the start of the WWE version of ECW. How was it viewed in the creative room when you were told more writing? In other words, another hour of TV. Did anyone jump up and down and go to the ECW team?
That happened before I was there, unfortunately. So I didn't see how the reaction was to it. I came in on the sixth week of ECW. So I didn't see how the reactions were for, you know, more writing becoming a part of it.
Was Lagana being assigned to ECW seen as a promotion or being lost in a brand that Vince had lost interest in? What was the attitude about that?
Not sure, to be totally honest. The change on ECW and stuff like that, it's, you know, is it because you have faith that this guy is going to help make the show, or is it because Vince is going into, you know, or moving somebody down? It's all a matter of perspective, so.
Yeah. Nels Michael says, John, I've always been curious about the way CM Punk's first World Championship reign ended in September of 2008. Was it supposed to set off a feud with Randy Orton that never materialized, or was it some sort of punishment for Punk?
Again, I think that was one of those things that just is where the story called for. I don't recall there ever being enough heat with Punk that somebody would want to punish him. So I think it was just where the story ended up.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. I think it's just because this, you know, the stories are so ever changing on a day-to-day basis that, you know, that's where they felt at the time it needed to come to an end, and that's where they ran with it.
Otto from Minnesota says, is it better if we don't know who specifically is behind the Cranky Vince Twitter account, but can you tell us if you know approximately how many people have access to updating it? And do you think Vince has the Fink or someone keeping him abreast on what info has been leaked via the account, or is that small enough to fly under his radar?
The Cranky Vince account, I've heard stuff, but I don't know for a fact who it is. I imagine it's only one person because they've mastered writing in that character's voice.
Yeah.
I think it's almost better if you don't know, because when you don't know, it's like seeing, you know, the Wizard of Oz with the curtain pulled back.
Right.
It's not as funny anymore once you know who it is.
Yeah. And I actually haven't paid a ton of attention to it, so I didn't even know if that was a...
It goes in bursts, I'll say. Like, I'm not going to lie, I subscribe to it. It's,
yeah, I do too, but...
Every now and then, it's fun to just interact with the Angry Vince Twitter account.
Yeah.
It's just fun because, you know, whoever it is has a knowledge of a lot of stuff that goes on in the company, and he knew that my nickname was Pee-wee, and every now and then he'll talk trash to me as Pee-wee and stuff like that. So, it makes me laugh just because it's you know, something we would all do backstage. Like, people would impersonate Vince and stuff like that backstage. So, you know, why would it be any different if it's, somebody just doing it on Twitter or that in a public forum, you know?
Yeah, yep.
And the one thing that person hasn't done is they haven't revealed storyline stuff, you know?
Right.
It's not like they're leaking information that's going to cost the company thousands and thousands of dollars, you know?
It's relatively harmless and sort of just, yeah. I ran out of email questions because actually literally four people asked what storylines did you come up
did
with?
Did I pitch that didn't happen?
Yeah. It's funny. I didn't expect that there'd be that many. I knew there were a couple, but... But I have a couple more to wrap up, just a couple more notes I took here, if you have 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
How much did house shows play into the pacing of storylines and feuds and any decision-making you made on TV? Sometimes they'd announce matches ahead of time. You knew they could be changed. But did you on the creative team pay attention to the pacing of house show matches being presented and also pay attention to attendance and whether you felt the storyline was successful because house show attendance was up?
That wasn't so much for us to worry about because, you know, we didn't book the house shows. We would go on the house show loops once in a while to, like, see fan reaction and stuff like that, but we didn't take that into effect. It was, whoever's territory it was for booking it, you know, and stuff like that, they would be in charge of, you know, saying, hey, it's going to be, you know, John Cena versus CM Punk, and, you know, because... we would say, hey, this is where we're looking for the next month, so this is what you can advertise. Obviously, we keep stuff as spoiler-free as possible, but, you know, usually the one thing that we would pay most attention to with house shows was new characters. Like, are people believing that Vladimir Kozlov is a killer in the ring? You know, that's our bigger concern. Because you know that John Cena versus Randy Orton is going to be a match that people are going to care about and follow. You know, that reaction isn't as big of a deal as if are people buying this new guy. Like, my guess is that people were getting behind Ryback murdering people on house shows, and that's why he, you know, he's Ryback and not Skip Sheffield.
Right. Did Vince ever at a creative meeting, pitch meeting, say house show attendance is down, we need to blah, 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 or this guy is not getting over to house shows, decrease his push, this guy is getting over? Like, did he talk about – because – I ask that because at one point, you know, if you ask Bill Watts, every decision he made in Mid-South was based upon, as a booker, what was happening in terms of attendance and crowd reaction at house shows. And it does seem like the job that you had evolved to a very different level because it was a TV business.
Yeah. I mean, granted, the house show income is so important to WWE, but at the same time, you're not booking your TV based on what's going to make a good house show match. Because in the end of the day, a house show could tank because of, you know, a hurricane or a storm happening near that part of the country, whereas TV, if it flops, it's because the product that you yourself put on TV flopped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is that how you evaluate, like, what got the different weight, so to speak, in terms of whether you felt a show that you had a hand in or a great influence in, if it worked or not? What made you feel good about the job you did and take pride in it versus feel like, oh, this wasn't a good week? What was your gauge for judging that? Vince McMahon's reaction, the crowd reaction, TV ratings, a combination of all of it, other things?
It's a combination of all of it. I mean, you want to make sure your TV ratings aren't sinking, and you had to take into everything that was going on, especially with TV ratings. Like, if we had a Raw where all of a sudden something dropped off in a segment we could have been doing good on, we have to go look at Monday Night Football. Is there something that happened during the game that all of a sudden everybody had to click over to? Like, was it a major game that was going to be decided by a single play? You always want to see crowd reaction. You know, if you're in a live audience, and especially like if you're in Chicago, you can't base what John Cena's reaction is based off of Chicago. You can't base punk off of it either, because everybody's there is going to, by default, cheer for one and boo for the other.
Yeah.
But you'd want to go, you know, somewhere in the middle of the country that doesn't have an allegiance. You'd want to see where things would end up with them. You know, who actually cares about this guy as champion? Santino Morello is a great example, because originally our story for them was Santino was supposed to be the guy who was, you know, the Cinderella story, got pulled out of the crowd and, you know, became a champion. At first, yeah, first week, oh, it was a great feeling, especially because it happened to a guy from Italy in Italy. It was awesome. And then 3 weeks later, you're back to America. Nobody cares about a Cinderella story, and the crowd reaction is blah. So it was like, all right, where do we go to save this guy? Because keeping him as the miracle boy isn't going to keep his career going. And that's when they started doing the, you know, the fact that he's, you know, secretly speaking a little bit of, you know, English and stuff like that, and he became a scumbag with Maria, and then all of a sudden he became this great comedy character. Like, just those changes were more so because of, like, in-person gauging of a crowd reaction.
Hello, you people. I'm Pat McNeil. Every Sunday night, Greg Parks and I will bring you Wrestling Night in America here on PW Torch Livecast. We're on at 8 p.m. Eastern most weeks, or immediately following the night's pay-per-view. We'll talk Raw, SmackDown, NXT, GFW, New Japan, Ring of Honor, WWN, and all the latest wrestling news with your phone calls. So don't miss it. Be there.
You had a wrestling background coming into your job. Some people didn't. Were there different approaches with different creative team members, as best you could tell, in terms of I'm writing to entertain the TV viewers versus I'm writing to get a new wrestler over versus I'm writing to increase the buy rate next month? Because a lot of people have been fans a really long time, students in the industry a really long time, a lot of times look at the TV show and say, this is being written more like a soap opera with a disconnect, especially, you know, below the stuff Vince McMahon puts his hands on, a disconnect in terms of we're writing this to actually create a star who will draw because he's a babyface who fans are going to get behind. He's fighting an evil heel who doesn't deserve to win, and the fans want to see him get his own. It's sometimes that simple formula gets lost because they want to be really a skit will be written or an angle will be written that's clever and funny and more something about Mary or Saturday Night Live than what traditionally would draw and sell tickets and buys because fans want to see a fight.
I think it's really a balancing act. All those things you described are the different roles you need to take on, you know, doing writing for WWE. You know, sometimes you do need to worry about getting this new guy over because, you know, 3 months from now, John Cena is going to go shoot a movie. Right now, Batista is hurt and, you know, some other thing is happening where, you know, somebody's going to go do a promotional tour for something. And all of a sudden, your show has no babyface. So you have to write somebody as a babyface to get them over in 3 months' time to make sure your show has a top guy. So that's where you're writing to get a guy over. Other times, your show might need levity. You might have, like, this super serious show, but you need to let up for it because if it's serious, you're not going to feel how serious it is at the end because you didn't have moments of, you know, letting people relax and take everything in. And that's where you write one of those comedy skits. You know, and then sometimes you do need to just get a new guy on TV. You know, if there's a guy who is kind of towards the run of their developmental contract and it's like, hey, we either pull the trigger on this guy or we just wasted, you know, $100,000 putting them in developmental for 2 years and got nothing out of it. Let's at least do something with them, give them the shot and see if we could get something to happen.
Interesting. Yeah.
Well, and how do you fit all that into one show?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, it's fat. I mean, you know, people, when they don't know about pro wrestling at all and they hear what you've done and the time you spent in wrestling or hear what I've done, we do obviously very different things, but it's involved in pro wrestling. And people who don't know anything about it, they're just like, how do you write about that every week? How do you fill pages and write? It's like, it is so fascinating and it is so complex and sometimes made more complex than it needs to be and other times it's not as smart as it needs to be. But there's so many nuances about it. And I can imagine being somebody like you who knows the industry and the history and grew up a fan, seeing somebody come in who doesn't respect it and actually thinks it's simpler or has a complete ill-conceived notion of what it is, it has to be kind of frustrating. It had to have been frustrating to be part of that and around that.
You know what the funny thing is? It's like, you know, people say, how do you keep coming up with new stuff each week? You just do. It's like, it's ingrained in you. It's like, if you love wrestling, you can continually think of new ideas for it. You know, the equivalent is the comic book writer. The Amazing Spider-Man comic book is about to hit its 700th issue. And that's just the Amazing Spider-Man. Like, you look at all the spin-off titles and all, like, the concurrent titles that have been going around the same time. There's been over 1,000 Spider-Man stories told, easily. Yeah. Even if you're saying what takes up more than one issue, stuff like that. But yet these guys, who are comic book writers, are still able to come up with a new Spider-Man story every month. It's the same with wrestling.
Yep.
It's Spider-Man interacting with the Avengers this week. Is he interacting with the X-Men this week? And it's the same with wrestling. You could tell a John Cena story every week for 52 weeks, but some weeks he's interacting with this superhero. Some weeks he's interacting with this supervillain. It's the same mentality, and it's really the same story process. You know, a comic book universe like Marvel or DC is just a printed version of the WWE. You have stories all going on concurrently at the same time, and sometimes they intersect, and, you know, you have a different baby face squaring off against a different heel. It's the same storytelling process, it's just a different medium.
What surprised you the most about Vince McMahon compared to your preconceptions about him after working around him and with him for a few years?
Vince is like, he's such a paradox, man. He's one of my favorite people to work with, but he's also one of the scariest people to work with. You know, like we talked about with Michael Hayes, Vince is always teaching. But when Vince gets pissed, he is the scariest dude on earth.
Yeah.
I have been told I produced the worst segment on ECW history of ECW TV. And he screamed at me. He was going off on me for it. And that's like professionally one of the most terrifying things, because not only is it your boss who ultimately has control over your job, but Vince himself is just an imposing figure. You know, as old as he is, he could still kick my ass in a street fight, I'm sure, if he wanted to.
Yeah.
And when this guy is like towering over you, letting you have it, what are you going to do? You just, you kind of got to take it, and, you know, you take your lumps. So learning from him was phenomenal, but being scolded by him was absolutely terrifying.
Was there anything about him? Did you expect that to be Vince McMahon, or did that kind of the relationship and what you learned about him, did the aspects of that surprise you?
I didn't realize there would be as much of a temper as there was. Not to say he was overreacting to the situation, because, you know, when it comes down to it, there are millions of dollars at stake for everything that happens. But at the same time, you know, is this guy who's screaming at John Cena or CM Punk on TV the same guy you're going to experience backstage?
Yeah.
And to an extent, it is. I think that's why Vince is so good as Vince as a character on screen, because all the greatest wrestlers and personalities in wrestling are just whoever they are as a person turned up to an 11, and that's what Vince is.
What do you think of John Cena as a top act and his relationship with Vince McMahon as part two of that question?
Cena is what the company needs right now. I don't think with where the direction Vince has taken everything with the PG world of wrestling doesn't work for me. I you know, like almost everyone I know says they stopped watching wrestling after the Attitude Era. I think that's what works for wrestling for a fan perspective, but from a money-making perspective, the company is doing better and they're making more money with this PG world, and John is probably the best figurehead for that. And I think that's why him and Vince have such a good relationship, is because, you know, John has made Vince so much money. You know, you look at merchandise and stuff like that, and John's still young. John has, you know, however many years left on his career to continue to make Vince money. So, you know, it'd be a mistake to burn that bridge in any case, because John's making money and Vince is making money off of it. And the fact that the two of them get along is just a bonus.
Triple H, as somebody who is kind of a hybrid management, family, and main event wrestler, how did he interact with the creative team, and what was your opinion of him?
He's a lot funnier than I expected.
Yeah.
You know, especially at the time where...
Is it always at someone's expense, John? Is it always at someone's expense, though? That's his rep.
It depended.
Yeah.
Like he would make jokes and stuff like that, but they were never cruel jokes.
Okay.
Like, it's just his joke-telling style.
Right.
Like, you know, the writing team, we abused each other. You know, as much as I said that, you know, we all get along, like, DJ and I were nicknamed the number 10 because I'm tall and skinny and DJ's shorter and rounder.
Yeah.
We were also called C-3PO and R2-D2, again,
oh,
for
funny.
The same reasons.
Yeah.
But, you know, Triple H would come into the writer's room and, you know, we get along with him professionally and everything. But when he comes in the room, he would say, "Hey, Geek Squad."
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just the personality of him. You know, you take the good with the bad. And, it's not like he was ever saying stuff to make you feel like a piece of garbage or anything like that. It was just funny. That's his style. You know, certain comedians, you know, have situational. Some have, you know, humor that aims at other people, but it was never, at least it never felt like cruel intention stuff, so.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, that's good. What did you think of what he contributed to creative when he did interact with you?
At the time that I was there, his creative interaction was more so production meeting type stuff. He wasn't involved in the level that he is now.
Yeah.
You know, he has a wrestling mind. He's been able to get himself over so well with an audience because he understands what gets over in wrestling. And, you know, he would always, you know, say that in meetings and stuff like that, what he thought was going to help get the current story over or what he didn't think was working with the story.
Yep. Yep. My final question.
Yes.
You rode on the private airplane, and I've heard, I think it was, everybody who isn't Dave Lagana in TNA or currently working for WWE and creative, everybody you mentioned has been on the live cast before, and they all have told, or most of them have told, unwritten rules and discovering those the hard way. Some of them were on during traveling, you know, don't stick your hand in the peanuts, you know, that
yep.
kind of thing. Don't sit in the wrong spot. Maybe talk a little bit about being on the private plane, travel stories, or unwritten rules. Any combination of those, something that comes to mind that the listeners might like to hear about.
Two quick stories about the plane, because I don't want to keep people, you know, they've been listening to me for, 2 hours now? So, funniest thing I ever saw on the plane. There is always the rule, if Vince is not sleeping on the plane, you do not sleep on the plane. And again, unsaid, unwritten rule. Vince will never, ever tell you that. But if you fall asleep on the plane, somebody's going to mess with you.
Wow.
And one of the directors, I will withhold his name, fell asleep on the plane. And Vince started taking the cashews and throwing them at him, like
yeah.
one or two at a time. And there was no reaction. Like, he was out cold, not waking up from this. And then Vince just said, screw it. And he took the entire tin of cashews, threw it at this director, and they go all over the plane. And all of us are like, we don't know if it's awkward or if we should just start break out laughing at this point.
Right.
And then to this director's credit, because he'd been in the company for a long enough time that he knew when to take his lumps and when to pick his fights, he opens his eyes, looks around, sees the nuts all over the place, and he goes, Vince, I think you dropped your nuts. And then it was a big laugh by everybody. So it was
yep.
it was like you knew how to handle the situation, and that's why this guy is one of the survivors in the company, because he played that part perfect. It's like Vince got his laugh and got to throw stuff at him, and then, you know, it wasn't a fight that came out of it. It was just people letting off steam, and, you know, everybody was able to laugh about it. And at the end of the day, all this guy had to do was stand up, and all the nuts fell off him anyway. It's not like, you know,
yeah.
his clothing had been ruined or anything like that. So, the other thing on the plane was, at first, I didn't know if Vince knew my name. The first time I met him, you know, I went up in the writers' meeting. I introduced myself. I said, hi, I'm John Carl. I'm one of your new SmackDown writers. You know, he acknowledged me. And then for, like, the first month, I was, like, always very timid about saying stuff to him, even in meetings. Again, because I was so new to the team, and I was only a writer's assistant at the time. I wasn't a full-fledged writer. And then all of a sudden, one day, we were flying back from England, and we were all starving, and they would always have like finger foods, like quesadillas and stuff like that on the plane. You know, especially long flights, people were going to get hungry. So the flight attendant came back, asked the writers if we wanted anything. Vince had already said no, so it's not like we were jumping ahead of him. And she brings out a quesadilla for me, and Vince looks over and he goes, John. And I'm just like in shock because I didn't even know he knew my name.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yes, sir. And he goes, how is it? And I took a bite and I was like, oh, it's good. And like, at that point, I had been eating food in England, and this is no offense to any of your British listeners, but the food there is absolutely atrocious.
I think they know that.
Oh, as long as they're aware of it. But
yeah,
so anything you could have given me at that point, I would have been happy to eat.
Yep.
So he goes, okay, I'll have one. And then, you know, a few minutes later, she comes out with the quesadilla for him, and he takes a bite of it, and he looks at me, and he goes, John, I won't be asking your advice on food anymore.
Oh, funny.
Because apparently it was not up to his standard. He must have been eating much better in England than I was, but that was one of my favorite interactions with him, because it was just so – it was totally good-natured, and it kind of made me feel like I had moved on to that next level with him, that, one, not only did he know my name, but he was actually able to joke with me. And I feel like that's – when the boss is able to joke with you, you're at least safer. You know, it's
yeah.
In the early months, everything you do, you're scared of. You're worried that you're going to be screwed at any point. So, having that finally happen was a great moment.
Very cool,
right.
John. It has been an absolute pleasure. I appreciate your generous time with us today.
No, thank you for having me. You know, like I said, I love being able to talk to people about my time there, and it honestly. It humbles me that people are interested in something that I was able to do. So, you know, thank you for giving me that exposure and being able to share some of my story with people.
And maybe we won't go as long, but if you are able to make a repeat visit sometime in 2013, maybe.
Yeah,
we can,
I mean, it wouldn't be till like mid-2013 until we can land a Friday where we can both crisscross again anyway, I feel like. So that'd
be
great.
It might even be fun to bring you on with one of your ex-colleagues and try that dynamic too. I did that once before, and I think it was Alex and Andrew together, and it worked out really well.
Yeah, those two together just have a phenomenal dynamic. We did a podcast with Lagana when we were all reacting to the pipe bomb promo.
Yeah.
And I think me and David almost backed off a little bit just because of Alex and Andrew being able to play off each other so well. But, yeah, I'd definitely be open to doing something again in the future.
Sounds great. Well, again, thanks very much, and great insight, great information, and good stuff. So
all
very
right.
Much appreciate it, and we'll stay in touch. And again, people can follow you on Twitter. You're trying to get to 2,000, so please follow.
Yeah, we
right
during
now.
The course of this interview, I jumped up 13, so we're on our way there.
That's a good start, and our delayed listenership over the weekend is about 1,000 times bigger than our live listenership. So,
awesome.
We should at least be able to get 130 added then, or wait. 13. We'll get you up to 3,000. No, that's overstating it.
3,000? That'd be phenomenal.
That'd be really
if
cool.
If I get 3,000, whoever my 3,000th follower is, I have a limited edition framed poster magazine cover from WWE. I'll send it to that 3,000th person if we get up to it.
But see, the problem now is everybody's going to hold out until it's 2,000. You know, until it's like 2,998.
Yeah.
So you're just going to be stalled at your number.
It's fine. I'll deal with 2,998.
Yeah, very good. All right, thanks, John.
All right, awesome. Thank you, Wade.
Take care.
Bye.
PW Torch Livecast listeners, I invite you to get even more of what the Torch offers by becoming a PW Torch VIP member. Not only do you get ad-free access to our website, the mobile site, and the desktop site, and access to about 30 years of our archives, including over 1,500 back issues and thousands upon thousands of hours of our audio shows going back to 2004, plus tons of retro radio shows from the 1990s. But you also get over 15 VIP exclusive podcasts per week, in addition to ad-free editions of these PW Torch livecasts throughout the week. So we take the ads out of the PW Torch livecast for VIP members and then give you over 15 other podcasts per week, including what started it all, the Bruce Mitchell Audio Show. I host that with Bruce every weekend, and we spend a couple hours talking about the biggest stories of professional wrestling and wrestling history. It's one of the longest-running weekly pro wrestling podcasts on any subject, and it's one of the main reasons people go VIP and stay VIP. Another is The Fix with Todd Martin. I host that every midweek with Todd, and we get Todd's expertise and opinions every midweek on current events in professional wrestling, not just WWE, but all promotions worldwide, including New Japan. Plus, we end every show with some expert MMA talk from the LA Times columnist and Sure Dog contributor, Todd Martin. And there's so much more. The Every Single Day Weight Killer Hotline with news updates every single day, Monday through Friday. And every Saturday and Sunday, I do the Ask the Editor format of the Waykeller Hotline, where I answer VIP member questions in depth. And there's so much more. There's the Wayback Playback with Pat McNeil and Jim Valley, Wrestling Audio Community with Sean Radican, the WWE Future Past Show with scouting reports on prospects, and a look back at the indie career of current stars, the PW Torch East Coast Cast Extended VIP Edition, the retro radio shows. Every Thursday, a new retro radio show from the 90s drops, from the early 90s or the Attitude Era. And last but not least, my in-depth Raw and SmackDown reports. You can get a full chronological rundown of every episode of Raw and SmackDown with my analysis of the show in-depth every Monday night and Tuesday night. So check out details at pwtorch.com/govip. We give you a lot here at the live cast, but there is so much more. The vast majority of our work is for our VIP members, and you can become one today. Go check out details on a subscription at pwtorch.com/govip.